Well, good morning. Thanks for everybody showing up, and thanks for the opportunity to speak with you guys today. I'm going to be talking about maybe a little bit different approach to some of the other topics in this session, but anyway, we're looking at soil physics algorithms to predict volatile organic chemical source strengths. This particular talk is focusing on soil fumigants, and for those who aren't familiar with soil fumigants, they're very volatile organic chemicals that are used to control nematodes and crop diseases, etc., in high-value crops. And so they're typically injected deep into the soil where they volatilize, turn into a gas, and as they're coming toward the atmosphere, they're killing, of course, what they're intended to kill. But you have the potential for bystander exposure if it leaves the soil surface. So we're looking at modeling to help predict some of these soil fumigant emission profiles so we can get a clearer understanding of what might be the exposure potential. So the purpose of this particular talk is to demonstrate the use of some soil physics modeling as an efficient and reliable predictor for these emission strengths. And that will compare some modeling results against some large field scale trials, and then looking at some different management practices. But ultimately, we want to couple the source strength with air dispersion modeling so we can get ideas for air concentrations that people and or non-target animals, et cetera, might be exposed to. We've done actually quite a bit of air dispersion modeling, and the source strength for those exercises comes from field trials. So we take basically, our company has done five or six of these trials, and other companies have done similar amounts, and usually you take the one that had the highest emission rate, and that's what you use as your source term. Obviously, it doesn't take any consideration of the variability in soils or meteorology, et cetera. So we want to use modeling to try to bridge that semi-infinite parameter combinations that we know do exist and get more realistic predictions. And we're using a public domain model developed by USDA at Riverside, Chain2D, and also its sister model, Hydrus, and there's been quite a bit of publications on this particular modeling system. We've had to make some modifications to make it more amenable to soil fumigation, and for most fumigations now they use tarps to try to seal the fumigant into the soil for better efficacy and also try to limit the release to the atmosphere, so we had to modify it for that. And also typical agronomic practices, they rip the tarp and then they transplant plants into the tarp, so obviously if you've got fumigant under the tarp and then you put a big tear in it, you can have a large release of fumigant also. And that's all coming in through a boundary condition, a mass transfer coefficient at the soil surface. And that, as you can see, related to the straight diffusion process, you can relate that mass transfer coefficient to the diffusion coefficient, the surface area, and the height of that boundary layer that it has to diffuse through. So in essence, you just alter that diffusion boundary thickness, and you can mimic different mass transfer coefficients. Okay. And we are taking some lab work and proposals from Wang et al., who basically proposed temperature dependence on this mass transfer coefficient. So we utilize that. There's a lot of experimental measurements out there that measure the mass transfer coefficients. It's a function of the polymer, the film that you use, and also the thickness, and is temperature dependent. So you can see this is how, in essence, we fake Chain2D into predicting it has a tarp at the soil surface. It's just an example of a field trial conducted in Salinas, California. We're looking at the flux profile over time. I've got the discrete on the left and the cumulative on the right. And I should say these are all uncalibrated. The only calibration that we have is we predict that, or we know what the soil texture is. We get the hydraulic properties from the Van Gennuken relationships that are correlated to soil texture. So that's, I wouldn't say it's a calibration. We're just taking the best available information. We're not taking any field measured values and plug it in and try to get a good fit. And you see the fit on this is actually quite remarkable. This is for another soil fumigant, chlorpicrin, and again we get pretty decent comparisons. This one was in Arizona under extremely dry conditions. Here's one example where we had tarp splitting. You can see the two peaks on the one on the left. That second peak is due when they rip the tarp to plant their plants in there. And again, these different areas and different types of applications for fumigation, the model is pretty capable of predicting both the cumulative and the peak losses, which is what we need for if we're concerned about like human exposure. So with that, you can look at various mitigation practices, and through the examples on the left is just if you inject your fumigant deeper in soil, then you have less loss, and you can at least try to quantify what that is. And the graphic on the right, that just shows when can they split the tarp. If they wait longer to split it, then you have less mass loss. It's just because the fumigant can degrade in the soil if it's being held there by that tarp. Another thing you can look at is soil-water content. If you increase the soil-water content, then you decrease the emission losses. So all these things are easy things that the applicators can apply, or that we can specify on labels, for example, to try to get farmers to limit or reduce their emissions that they might be having. I mentioned about the lab-measured mass transfer coefficients. We can look at that numerically, too, and here's where we can get the efficacy information, because we can get the concentrations in soil over time. This is at an injection depth of 18 inches, but we also get the mass loss coming off the surface through that tarp, and you can see you can have different percentage losses depending on the different polymer materials that you use. So that is an area that Dow is focusing or has focused on, because they are big manufacturers of polymers and plastics, so they can tune various materials to try to minimize emission losses. We have multiple stakeholders here. You've got the farmers who need to use these products because they work. You know, without them, people wouldn't be buying their product. But then you've also got the exposure potential. So we need to try to couple things that work with, that farmers can live with, and that also regulatory bodies and the risk to humans is minimized. And I don't have the graphic with this, but it's pretty straightforward. This is just a Gaussian plume model. So this just shows like air concentrations from the source, which is that rectangle box in the middle. Over many days. This just basically would illustrate meteorological variability. The wind blows from different directions at different speeds, and of course your source strength is not constant, as we saw in some of those emission profiles. Usually it's larger at the beginning, following application, and kind of slowly fades out over time. So you've got this transient problem. So this is where the air dispersion modeling comes in. This is just an example of two air dispersion models that were used. ISCSD3 and CalPUF6 EPA models to try to get a handle on what the air concentrations are from a given source. And that example that I showed, they're pretty close. But the thing is, a single field does not give you necessary exposure. You've got one field where somebody can be exposed, but in agricultural areas, you've got hundreds or thousands of fields that are being treated, you know, almost, I wouldn't say simultaneously, but within a narrow window. And all those are transient source terms for air concentration. So we have to consider multiple fields, not just a single field. So where do some of these source terms come? This is where we use GIS information and databases and surveys and whatever data that we can get to get a feel for how big are the fields, where are they located. So the graphic on the far right, that shows like a mountain range in a city, and all those little squares, those are actual farmers' field source terms. The different colors represent different agronomic practices, because those farmers are growing like different crops. A carrot might get a different application than like a potato, for example, or a crop. So we try to encompass all that different variability. Here's just an example of two areas in California where you can actually get or predict air concentrations. And California has measured air concentrations for fumigants and a lot of organic compounds. And we can't say it's a validation. We get the right order of magnitude. It's not a validation because California didn't know exactly where the fields were at the time, and they do a lot of averaging. They might suck air for like 2-week interval, for example. So you get a lot of stuff that kind of gets integrated out. But we do get the similar orders of magnitude and peaks so that we're seeing, or that California monitoring has saw. So ultimately, we want to use the soil physics modeling to be the source strength. And on that one graphic where you saw all those little squares, all those are source terms, and they all are at different strengths given the agronomic practices, the meteorological conditions, et cetera, at that time. So we're coupling the soil attributes, basically getting soil texture from soil databases, and coupling that with Chain2D to feed in these air dispersion models to calculate these long-term or short-term air concentrations. So with that conclusion, the comparison of model prediction to field observations is actually pretty good, probably a lot better than most people would have expected. From an engineering standpoint, you say if you're in the right order of magnitude, that's pretty good. I mean, we were even a lot closer than that. So we nailed the peaks and the cumulative mass loss pretty good, at least on the field trials that we had available to us to judge that. Like any model in general, I mean, it extends the parameter space for mitigation scenarios of what you didn't measure or couldn't measure experimentally under field trials. It allows us to look at various mitigation strategies to figure out what's the most sensitive, which one, if we have to specify one or two or more, which one we're going to get the most bang for our buck. And again, we're tying up, hopefully, the latest data information that we have to try to provide the most realistic regional exposure assessments. That's all I had. Thank you.
Any questions for Stephen?
Very, very nice presentation and important upscaling from the plot scale to regional scale. Now, I wonder about the vegetation and uptake and maybe when you're trying to upscale from the field into the regional scale, if this is taken into account in the wind and water uptake, the presence of dust.
No. If you look at from a source strength standpoint, all these applications are made to bare soil, so you're not going to have any losses from plant uptake. You can put like a sink term, if you know what that was, in any of these like finite element models to say, okay, this is the uptake from the roots or whatever. But in this case, obviously, if there's no plants growing, we didn't need that. From the air dispersion side of things, yes, you do account for like the topography, and you can. There are like extrapolation programs. Usually use historical data to drive the air dispersion modeling. So you get like hourly information, which way the wind's blowing, what's the magnitude. And it varies. It makes like a log transform for the velocity profile near the surface. It's not as complex as like what you're going to get for a lot of the more intense climate modeling, like the large eddy diffusion, that type of stuff. But it's convectively driven. So it's getting you in the ballpark for regions near the breathing regions of humans, that's what we're interested in. But once it's in the air, again, you can have sink terms if you know how to quantify those, but we're just ignoring that. So once it's in the air, you can specify like a pseudo degradation of the chemical as it's moving around, but other than that, we haven't looked at possible like absorption to buildings or trees or uptake of plants and that sort of thing.
Oh, there's the other guy.
To share with you my personal experience and see if we can merge things together. We have a laboratory in which we take not the metal bromide, but the metal bromide, but the alternative for the metal bromide. And we do prediction for the growers on bare soil. They bring us their soil samples, and we measure the depletion rate of the emission, the rate of emission from the soil, and then we can give them kind of consultancy about the first whether the fumigant is working, and second, how much they have to apply to the soil in order to be effective. That these are the two things. However, it costs them. It's about $100 a sample. Doesn't work, then they complain. You told us that it works and we have to put this and this and this, very expensive, and it didn't work for us. The microorganisms developed and the fungus damaged the field. So the question, I understand the problem is, of course, the spatial variability of the sampling, but how can we merge the two approaches, yours and mine? Assuming that we understand your calculation.
With the use of models in general, I mean, if you're assuming they're right or mimicking the actual mechanisms, then you can get a hand around the uncertainty, the parametric uncertainty, just by giving uncertainty to the input parameters. So if you know what the variability might be in soil properties, you can specify that as an input and run these things like in a stochastic fashion under Monte Carlo simulation or something like that to get a range of potential outputs. And then you would, and that's, since you wouldn't give a single number to your grower, you would say you would have this percentage of times it won't work under these conditions, and that at that application rate, and then they'd have to decide if they could, are willing to live with that risk or not.
How long did you measure the emission? We measure it actually first several short hours, and then up to 5 days.
Yeah, the field trials are all typically carried out for 2 weeks. Yeah, and the modeling, it would show you roughly when it starts peaking out, when your cumulative losses don't increase anymore. And that's usually about 10 days or so.
One more short question. Let me get the, someone
in the back. Go ahead. It seems to me that soil disturbance should be part of your model. How much the soil is disturbed, how much the macro pores are present or not present, what the texture of disturbance is.
That's correct. And the particular system that we're using, we're assuming everything right now is homogeneous, with the exception of, I didn't emphasize it, but when you pull a knife blade through the soil, obviously you're disturbing it pretty dramatically. And what they try to do is that they cover it back up and they press it down to try to compact it back down. But in essence, you might have this very, not very dense, fluffy soil that got disturbed that would almost be like a chimney effect for transport. And yes, we can account for that, and we have accounted for that. You just have to change the soil properties for that. But unfortunately, we and nobody else has ever measured how they change by those knife traces getting pulled through the soil. There's a lot of work out there where people say, I've got this great application equipment. If you use this press wheel with, this disc, you don't get as much emission losses, but nobody's ever quantified other than maybe looking at the volatility in general, saying, okay, this is what it was under these conditions. But you're right. You're exactly right. If you've got macro pores and stuff and you know how to quantify that, then really you need to account for that.
Thank you, Steve. Next speaker this morning is Sang Lee from North Carolina State University.